Hi, my name is Michael Wolf Siegel. You may be more familiar with me as the Farmer in the Sky. This is my kind of biography, my piece of dope history.
Wolf Siegel is a name that many of the founders know, but the current generation of growers and enthusiasts may only know the name of his contributions because they use them as standard practice. Wolf was introduced to the world of cannabis, beatnik culture, and self-reliance at an early age. His childhood was less than traditional, and during this time he was introduced to the concepts revolving around human rights, geopolitical tensions, and drug culture. Oftentimes, he was left to his own devices, and as the naturally intelligent and creative person he is, he made the best of those times.
I was born to a violinist named Abe Siegel in Greenwich Village. They called him Crazy Abe Siegel in Greenwich Village in the 50s, and a very, very smart lady named Ruth. My parents were beatniks. For those who are young enough to not know about them, the beatniks are where the hippies came from. The beatniks were about jazz. They were puffing reefer in the 50s in Greenwich Village. And among the people that my parents were puffing reefer with was a writer named Jack Kerouac, who wrote a book called On the Road that developed into a lot of what the hippie culture grew from. I'm told by my 87-year-old Aunt Sarah that my parents were puffing reefer with their circle of friends in the 50s. So I can honestly claim, and this was while I was in utero, so I can honestly claim to have smoked pot with Jack Kerouac before I was born. You've seen or heard the bumper sticker, "I have THC in my DNA." For me, based on that, it is literally true. And it may very well be that that is a piece of why I've become who and what I've become. People have to understand that the hippie thing had started down in California, in Haight-Ashbury. And the scene in Haight-Ashbury in 1967, if you walked down the street, people would be asking you, do you want to buy a lid, acid, mescaline? And I mean, not just one or two, a lot. It was like a street bazaar. And social phenomenon are a lot like the ripples from dropping a rock in a pond. So the rock that was hippie dropped in San Francisco in 66 and 67 gets to Seattle in 69. So to 1969, my mom was still Ruth Wolf, lady journalist for Seattle Magazine. And she wanted me to go and see what it was like to sell the Helix, which was the underground newspaper in Seattle. And while I was there, I met this Mexican guy named Frank and his old lady Ginger and their little kid Chuck and their dog Duke, and started hanging out with them that summer. And they dealt on the street. They dealt pot. And the way it worked when you were dealing on the Ave, which was University Ave in those days, unless you were old enough and had bought your own, was there was three or four people who hung out over on campus on Hippie Hill at the University of Washington. And you would run over there. They were what we called fronts. You would get fronted a lid, usually for $8 or $9. And you would go to whoever you'd found that wanted to buy one. You'd take a pinch, you know, roll a joint for yourself, and take it to whoever was waiting to buy it and get $10, $11. So you'd pick up a couple bucks. And if you sold four or five lids in a day, you had enough to, $10 bought a lot of food in those days. You'd probably be flopping at some crash pad. And that was the lifestyle. So I did that summer, and then I went back to school up in Canada in the fall that I was 13. And while I was up in Canada, my mom turned hippie, dropped back out, went back to being bohemian, because she had tried being straight. That was the Ruth Wolf lady journalist thing. And he went out on the road. So a little bit before Christmas, I'm at school up in Canada, and I get a call to come and take a ferry down from Tsawwassen, British Columbia, or from Victoria, I forget which it was, down to Anacortes, and she'll meet me there. So I get there, and there she is. She hasn't got a car. We hitchhike down to Seattle. A couple days later, the guy she had fallen in love with calls her from Anchorage and wants her to come up there. So she goes up there to be with him and leaves me with a couple of guys 3 or 4 years older than me who also happened to deal on the street. And so that was how that happened. My mom ended up getting busted. She got busted on my birthday. They called me on my birthday and then walked back to their trailer on Kodiak. She and her guy had gotten busted for giving a minor some acid and some hash in Kodiak. She ended up doing 6 months in prison up in Alaska, and I was on my own in Bellingham. I ended up going up to Bellingham because some people that I knew were up there, and it worked out. My childhood prior to 14 is basically the story of a series of, well, basically serial abandonment, which is how I ended up in Bellingham alone at 14. Home ran away from me again. But the first time that I ever smoked cannabis, my mother and stepfather were in their bedroom. We lived on Bitter Lake in Seattle, and they called me in and said, look, you're going to start running into people at school that smoke pot and that do other drugs. We're not going to tell you not to do that. We smoke pot. We've done other drugs. What we want is, if you want to try something, come to us. Let us be sure that what you're getting is the real deal, is clean, and that you don't get in trouble taking it. And you want to try this? And I said, sure. And that was the first time I smoked pot. And like many people, I didn't think I was getting off that first time I smoked pot. I didn't notice anything different. But my stepfather said, you may not notice. Here's some things that you might look for. Hold your breath and count and see how long it seems to take. And he was right. It seemed like time was different. And he said, move your hand through the air. You see how it looks like there's trails of light in back of it? That's the pot. So that first time that I got high on pot, I had to be told what it was I was looking for. Really, from 12 to 13, I probably smoked pot half a dozen times, and it was always with my mom and stepdad, or my stepdad and his buddy Clement. And, you know, it was fun. It was cool, but it wasn't as cool as fishing. I loved fishing more at that point. I was obsessed. But then I started getting into it more, and I was precocious, and I didn't really fit in with people my age. Most of the people I could relate to were someplace between 17 and 30. And they were all at that point into smoking pot, and they all laughed and thought it was really cute. This youngster was getting high. I was a baby hippie. I was a teeny bopper, but I was able to hold my own intellectually with them. And so they kind of got off. It was cute because, you know, it was sort of like a talking monkey. It's surprising when a 12-year-old or 13-year-old can come out with these long explanations of, for instance, why we didn't belong in Vietnam. And so, you know, I sort of created my own little niche. And then when I was out on my own, I fell in with a bunch of really good people up in Bellingham. And there's someone, the late George Kenneth Fox, Rising Power Kenneth. I attribute the fact that I didn't grow up to be a serial murderer or other weirdo to taking a lot of acid and being exposed to George Kenneth Fox and his old lady, Linda, who modeled healthy behavior for me. It was the first time I had ever really been around people who were loving and kind and generous and knew how to be people. And between being around that and the acid, I stopped being full of fear, anger, and hate, and learned to try to make the world better. And Kenneth modeled behavior that I would like to believe I have attempted to emulate. Kenneth was opposed to the war in Vietnam. Kenneth did not run off to Canada. Kenneth did not go into hiding. He flat out refused to be inducted. And when he refused to be inducted, he got put in prison down in Safford, Arizona. And one of the things I did when I was out playing Michael Marijuana Seed, I figured I was already as far south as Davis, California. So I hitchhiked 1,000 miles or so to Safford, Arizona, not knowing about Bureau of Prison rules. And they let me visit Kenneth, even though it wasn't a visiting day. And even though I hadn't been through the Bureau of Prisons procedure, I think they were so blown away that someone would hitchhike across the desert to come visit someone that it took them out of the being hard ass prison guard box. And plus it was a camp where things tend to be more relaxed than in a higher security joint. So I got to visit Kenneth, and then I went back and finished doing what I was doing that summer. But that was how I first smoked pot and how I made the step from being a total mental cripple, emotional cripple, because I really was, to working on being what my grandmother would call a mensch, you know, trying to do the right thing as much as possible. Obviously not succeeding all the time, who does, but at least trying.
Aspiring gardeners today have almost infinite resources to tap when it comes to tips and tricks for growing cannabis. Pre-internet, this was not a luxury most people had. It is safe to say that within the first few years of cannabis growing, growers learned terms like sea of green and screen of green, also known as scrog. These techniques aren't ancient practice. They're actually something that came from the mind of Wolf Siegel. What we consider commonplace today was once cutting edge, and it was Wolf Siegel who first wrote about this technique in the pages of Sensimilia Tips magazine. Later on, he smuggled out the blueprints for the screen of green technique under the watchful eye of the law to be published worldwide. Listen in as he describes the origins of these techniques.
And this is where I got the first clue to what would eventually become the Sea of Green method. When I got there, my friend Mike had planted a huge number of plants, but he had had so many plants that one plant hadn't got implanted, and it was growing out of a little 6-inch brown terracotta pot right next to his front door, and it was about 24 inches tall, and it was a solid baseball bat of flower. And I looked at it and I went, wow. And he said, yeah, it's kind of cool. I didn't have time to plant it. The roots have grown down through the hole in the bottom of it and look like that. I might try doing a bunch of those like that next year. And I said, wow, that's really cool. He didn't try it again the next year. But that was the sort of the first conscious clue. So then the next clue to what would become Sea of Green happens the following summer. I'm back over in Seattle, up in Ballard, which is a neighborhood there. And there's a place called Sunset Hill, which is a hill above the beach at Shilshole Bay and Shilshole Marina. And running along the bottom of the bluff that is Sunset Hill, maybe 50 feet from the bottom of the bluff, is a railroad track. And on the other side of the railroad track is a blackberry patch that runs, it's about a 3.5 mile long by maybe 100 to 125 feet thick patch. And I went, because I had had some reversals and I needed to plant, I didn't have a place to grow. And so I went to a friend of mine lived on Sunset Hill above the bluff. And I said, hey, can I stick a bunch of little plants here to move down into the blackberry patch? And my friend John said, yeah. So I set two upside down pallets up on the roof of the shed in his yard. And I stuck a whole bunch of plants in 20-ounce solo cups on there. And what I would do is I would, before the sun came up, I would come load up a backpack with water or plants, and I would go down and I would do my little Viet Cong number on the blackberry patch. I had little handheld clippers, the little tiny wisp ones, and I would cut tunnels very, very carefully, cut a tunnel in. And then when I'd get to the middle of the patch, I would cut a bunch of the stalks and pull the blackberry plants down under the ones I hadn't cut so they wouldn't make brown splotches in the middle of this that could be seen from overhead. And I planted about 2.5 to 3 miles every 100 feet or so. I put 2 or 3 plants. Now, I planted a mess of plants there. I ended up getting quite a few. I think I pulled 5 or 6 pounds out of that long stretch, which, with what money was back then, that wasn't a bad crop. It wasn't a huge crop by any means. But I managed to pull a crop out of there, but I didn't get all of the plants down there. There was about 6 of the plants that were still in the 20-ounce solo cups in the upside-down pallets on top of my friend John's shed. And John and his wife and I kept them alive all summer. And what we ended up with there was these 18-inch long buds out of these 20-ounce solo cups. That was the second clue to what would eventually become Sea of Green. The final clue to Sea of Green, the method, was looking at a 6-foot plant, actually a bunch of 6-foot plants, and going, huh, there's only really 18 to 24 inches on that plant that is worthwhile. Everything below that is junk. And yet we're growing 4.5 feet of what we now would call larf and lumber. And I started thinking about that, and 2 new developments had come along in growing indoors. One was what we were calling the mother plant method, which, you know, everyone goes, well, duh, but taking clones hadn't made it into cannabis until in the 80s. And it was, wow, you don't have to grow seeds and figure out if you got male or female. You can have a female plant and take cuttings, and all your plants are going to be females, which really, I mean, it's a well duh now. Most great discoveries, most great changes are well does. It's sitting there waiting to be discovered, and no one does until the first person finds it. And they talk about it, they publish it, they make people aware of it, and everyone else goes, once they see it, well duh. Most of the great discoveries have been well does, I believe. And certainly in cannabis, this is true. Because, for instance, Sea of Green really was a well duh. Once you think about inverse square law, once you're taking cuttings, once you've seen that you can grow a healthy ass flower out of a small container, it doesn't make sense to waste time and energy growing. If you can grow a plant that will be what it can be grown as a big plant, there's no reason not to grow it as a single flower, as a spear. And that was Sea of Green. Sea of Green eventually led, I got to jump around a little. Sea of Green led to the birth of Screen of Green, which was sent out of the federal joint at Sheridan, Oregon via legal mail in the fall of 1991. And it was sent out because when I got there, because of the way that sentencing was, 1,000 grams per plant for people after the date that I stipulated mine was before, I didn't want people to be getting hit for 1 kilogram of cannabis for a plant that, if they were lucky, was going to give them 50 or 60 grams of flower. So while that's a really high productive method, because you do it 6 to 6.5 times a year on an 8-week from the flop method, it was still, for sentencing purposes, this horrendous thing. Someone might have a tray of clones and get charged with 50 kilos. So that was bad. And then Keel Green, because of the method, people were starting to get busted for incredibly high plant counts. And so I wanted to figure out a way to have the advantages, or most of the advantages, of Sea of Green, but without the plant counts. So I sat down and I combined methods. I combined what we called candelabra, which nowadays is called manifold or manifolding, combined that with what we call plant bondage, which nowadays is LST, low stress training, and basically figured out that with a 2-foot by 2-foot screen, I could fill, should be able to fill that 2-foot by 2-foot screen horizontally with an upright meristem every 6 to 8 inches, which is what Sea of Green is, single meristem spears at 6 to 8 inch centers, one row next to the other, ideally in square containers, ideally staggered slightly to get the volume maximum. And so I'm like, how can I do this? How can I give people these kind of yields without them facing these kind of sentencing things? And figured that out. Then I had to figure out how to get it out to the public. Fortunately, my attorney in Seattle, I won't say his name, but his initials are JS, and he's very active with HempFest, or was. But through legal mail, I was able to get the Screen of Green out to High Times. They didn't really write about it much, but a few years later, they put out a video in which what I call plantlet method was called Sea of Green. Now, this has been sort of a source of, my ego is involved in this. I came up with something that changed the face of one very small piece of human endeavor. I don't have kids because I was in prison during the entire time I would have had kids. So to me, what you're doing right now is really, really important, because the only legacy I'm going to leave is the things that I brought to cannabis.
Left to his own devices as a young teen, there were only a few options for Wolf when it came to being self-supportive. Wolf chose the path of dealing dope, which was the path that he saw played out before him in many of the people in his early life. While selling his lids, he started collecting seeds from the cannabis he bought. And after reading a few books about cannabis cultivation, Wolf was inspired to grow, and he set out on a summer-long adventure planting cannabis seeds up and down the West Coast. This adventure brought him to some interesting places and to the doorsteps of some pretty interesting people.
Here's some history for people that don't know it. The term lid is what we used to call a bag of pot, but a lid got its name because when it was first being done, what it was your dealer would grab as big a handful of pot as they wanted and pile it on the lid of a 1-pound tobacco tin. However much they chose to pile on there was a lid. A really good lid would be 4 or 5 fingers. That was a healthy ass lid when you consider how much seeds weigh. And there was a lot of seeds and stems. So I started dealing pot. I sold my first lid at 13 on the Ave in 1969. I was on my own at 14. At 14, I was one of the 2 or 3 biggest pot dealers in Bellingham, Washington, a very liberal college town in northwestern Washington. Over the course of about a year of dealing, I had managed to work my way up. At 14, when you're on your own, you pretty much have 3 choices. You can steal, you can deal, or you can sell your ass. I'm not a thief, and I wasn't going to sell my ass. In the summer of 1970, I read Bill Drake's book, The Cultivator's Handbook of Marijuana. And Bill Drake's book was my inspiration. There's about a page and a half passage where it describes the quantum leap in detail. And it talks about how knowledge, awareness, and consciousness also undergo the quantum leap, but it described what's involved. And it ends with something that says, if you're going to be involved with lighting and with plants, you need to understand how serious a thing it is. Now, later that afternoon, when I read that book, I went on what I refer to as a pharmaceutical vision quest. A lot of us did that in those days. And in my case, LSD was the substance that I used in my vision quests. While I was on my vision quest that day, that evening, I experienced the presence of my spirit guide, which is the green goddess Ganja, the avatar of Ganja. Whether or not this was real or purely hallucination, it seemed real enough to me that when I went back to where I was living on the south side of Portland, I told the people I was living with about what I had experienced, and I told them that I had seen cannabis, except I didn't call it that, I called it pot, growing under indoor suns. Now, I had at that point no conception of what plant lighting was, other than just, you know, having glanced and going through reading it. He did mention that some people grew indoors under lights, but he didn't really go into it any detail. I came back from that pharmaceutical vision quest absolutely bound and determined that I was going to grow pot. But it was already August, so it was too late in the year to start. I saved up seeds, and in those days, pot had a lot of seeds, stems, and leaves in it because we hadn't really gotten to where Sinsemilla was widely known, although it is mentioned in the Cultivator's Handbook of Marijuana that you want to pull the males out. For me, that's why I give more power and more credibility to Drake's book than to Mary Jane Superweed's book. Because even though Mary Jane Superweed's book had the first light recipe for growing cannabis that I know of, it didn't have the part about removing the males, which is really what made growing cannabis domestically worthwhile. Without that, we don't really have a product that's worthwhile. So I saved seeds, and I saved seeds from August until mid-May. And then I went out on the road playing Michael Marijuana Seed. And by this, I mean that I took a bus from Bellingham down to Portland, Oregon, because you couldn't hitchhike at that point in Washington. In Oregon, you could hitchhike if you didn't hang out your thumb. You could have a sign that said where you were going. You could stand by the side of the freeway. So I got down to Portland and got over on the freeway. And right a little south of Eugene is Roseburg. And if you get off at Eugene and go over through Springfield, you can end up at a place called Pleasant Hill. On that first trip, I did that because I wanted to go over and see Keezy. And I figured if I showed up at the door and said, hey, can I crash here tonight? I've always wanted to meet you. Things were much more relaxed in those days that, you know, maybe I'd get to do it. As it happened, Keezy wasn't there, but other people were. And so I spent the night and it was fun, but then I took off. And that was that next day is really when the plan came together. Because what I did was I hadn't really known where or how I wanted to plant. I looked at a map. I knew that California and Southern Oregon, my gut was saying plant there. So I did. But what happened was every place I would hitchhike and every place that my gut said here, I would have whoever I'd caught a ride with let me out and I'd walk back up till I couldn't hear the road and I'd plant there. All told, I probably planted between 200 and 300 places between Eugene and the coast down to a little south of San Francisco, down into Santa Cruz area and up there, a little north, headed up 101, went across 196 and 296. People who are familiar with what I call the Emerald Polygon, because there's a lot more of it than a triangle, would know exactly what I'm talking about. This is the cannabis growing, at least the indica-based cannabis growing capital of North America. There's no place that grows it as well as Southern Oregon and Northern California, indica varieties. Sativa varieties, not so much. Hybrids, yeah. So I'm hitchhiking and I'm getting let out. I'm planting, walking back down to the road, hanging out my thumb. If traffic gets too slow going one way, I go the other way. Walk across the road, hang my thumb out. Eventually, I ran out of seeds. So I went back up to Portland. And while I was in Portland, I heard that there was some real Sandoz LSD on sugar cubes available up in Bellingham. So I hitchhiked back up to Bellingham, and there had been, and I got some. And I had a bunch of lids. My life has been very, very wrapped up in and around cannabis.
For almost as long as Wolf can remember, there were only about 15 years he wasn't growing cannabis, and those were the years he spent in prison. Coincidentally, he also took his first pot bust at the age of 15. But the time in between those two life milestones, he grew with a passion, both indoors and outdoors. Indoor growing was just starting to catch on, thanks to technological advancements and curious minds like Wolf. Wolf went big, and he spent many hours trialing different techniques and devices. He would then write about them as Farmer in the Sky for Sensimilia Tips. Through curiosity, collaboration, trial and error, Wolf pushed indoor growing advancements to a level not seen before. These contributions are irreplaceable to the advancement of cannabis horticulture.
I planted that summer of 71, played Michael marijuana seed, and on August 6th of 1971, I took my first pot bust. I got busted for sales and possession with intent to distribute marijuana and got put on probation until I was 18. I was at that point 15. It didn't slow me down any. Fortunately, I had some friends that were willing to be foster parents till my grandmother flew up from Puerto Rico to give me a place to live in Seattle, and I continued to grow. So let's see, from 15 to, God, I don't even remember for sure which year, I plant outdoors. I planted my first, there we go, my first indoor crop I planted in 1975. I read Murphy Stevens' How to Grow Marijuana Indoors Under Lights. Murphy Stevens was the pen name of Steve Murphy, the owner of the Indoor Sun Shop in Seattle. I bought a set of very high output Grolux lights from him and grew my first plants indoors in an attic on a very busy intersection in the Greenwood neighborhood in Seattle. And we got them all the way to flower. It wasn't anything really impressive. I mean, you know, it wouldn't even make it as mids these days, but it was a crop and it made it to flower. Now I continued to grow outdoors as well. And in those days, most of us that had been growing for a while felt like outdoor cannabis would get you off. And there was a difference between getting off and getting stoned. Getting off was what we now call a cerebral mental high. And getting stoned was the heavy physical couch lock ass anchor that gets attributed to being an indica trait. I don't like that taxonomy. People who've seen me write know that what I favor is a regional taxonomy that goes region, physical type, wide leaf, narrow leaf, medium leaf, drug type or not drug type, and then a number classification, whether it's a high THC, high CBD, equal THC to CBD, high other cannabinoid, or non-high cannabinoid, any. High being defined for this purpose as anything over 0.3%. In 1977, Steve Murphy brings out another book. It's called How to Grow the Finest Marijuana Indoors Under Lights, and it's about growing under high-intensity discharge lighting, halides, sodiums, mercury vapors. Mercury vapors don't get used anymore except for UV. It turns out they've put out a crazy amount of UV, so they can be used in large operations to supplement. If someone is supplementing UV, they should use proper personal protection equipment, sleeves, sunblock, sunglasses. because there are dangers, like with any other industrial process. You have to be careful. But the results when you do use UV in the correct proportions are amazingly better than without, which ties in with something that I'll be talking about later. Anyways, so I planted my first indoor crop in 1979. In 1981, I'm growing in an airplane hangar out at Creston Airport, which is a little southeast of Seattle, when I get a call from the electric company saying, "Mr. Siegel, you use an incredibly large amount of electricity. We'd like to send someone out next week to help you figure out if there's any way you could be using less electricity." And I tell them, "Well, I'm not going to be around next week. Can we set it up for the week after?" And of course, they agree because they're being reasonable. I'm being reasonable. And as soon as I get off the phone, I look around for how I'm going to deal with this. A friend of mine was growing up in northeastern Washington. Mike R. was growing out by Nespelum. And I called him up. Now, that's like 300 miles or so from where my airplane hangar full of plants that are about 2 weeks into flower are. And I call him up and say, "Mike, I've got a hangar full of plants that I have to move because the electric company wants to come see why I use so much electricity." And he says, "Well, I've got a mess of plants out here, but come on and bring them." So I figure out that I can rent a 40-foot U-Haul and put wardrobe boxes. It takes two boxes to put each plant in. You put the plant in, you tape the first wardrobe box, then you flip the second wardrobe box over the top and drop it down and tape it. And now you've got an enclosed hidden plant. So I filled the back of it and it reeked because these were a partial hash plant, Calgany hash plant that was really, really nice. It smelled really good. And I'm sitting there, I'm smelling it and I'm going, you know, if I get pulled over, I am so screwed. What can I do? And I already knew about the general rule of thumb, which is that if you can make cops laugh while you're interacting with them, if you can relax them, they tend to act more human. And so life gets a little easier. The handcuffs don't get tightened quite so tight. The hostility level drops because they don't think it's about to become a big fight. So I think about, what am I going to tell a cop if I get pulled over? And what I came up with was, "Officer, yeah, I know it really smells. What that is Himalayan mint. It looks like pot. It smells like pot, but it's not. Isn't it amazing how much like pot it looks and smells?" Now, I knew that he wouldn't buy it if I got pulled over for that, but that at least I might get the laugh and the more relaxed cop. Fortunately, I didn't get pulled over. I got some funny looks at the gas station where I had to refill the gas, but it went smooth. I get up there, and this is where I got the first clue to what would eventually become the Sea of Green method. So while this is going on, I am not just dealing with Indoor Sun Shop. I'm also dealing with a company called Hydrotech. Hydrotech was run by a guy named Kevin Bjornson. Kevin and I got to be pretty good friends. Kevin is, I like smart people. Kevin is a little crazy, but he's smart. And we're talking, and what ended up happening was I would go in to buy gear from Kevin. And while I was waiting for Kevin to take care of me because he was with some other customer, I would be waiting on the customers who came in after me. And this went on for a couple of years while I was a customer. Pretty much every time I'd go in, I would end up selling gear to the next one or two customers. But while this was going on, Kevin and his engineer, or the person who did the engineering for Hydrotech, a guy named Larry McMahon, were working on some new reflector design, something that wasn't like the Chinese coolie hat cones that were the predominant reflector used. And we went through a number of different designs. I was doing testing for them and giving them input. We went through one that looked like a pyramid, four-sided pyramid. We tried a three-sided pyramid. We tried a 8-sided octagonal paraboloid. We realized about halfway through this process, looking at radar antennas and such, that the paraboloid shape, not a true parabola, but very much like it, which is why paraboloid, would be the most efficient reflector. And at that point, I started writing with Kevin on the column Farmer in the Sky. Both Kevin and I were science fiction fans. Both of us liked Robert Heinlein. Heinlein wrote a book about terraforming Ganymede called The Farmer in the Sky. And so we thought that with growing indoors and with what we were doing related enough to terraforming, that The Farmer in the Sky was a good name for the column. At first, it was just an article in Tom Alexander's magazine, Since Mia Tips, Domestic Growers Journal, which Tom had begun printing. He began publishing it in 1980, and it ran through the summer. There were two issues after A Green Merchant in 1990. The Farmer in the Sky appeared in Since Mia Tips from 1982 through winter of 1988, writing as The Farmer in the Sky, having a nationally distributed magazine to talk about growing, gave us a podium to explore and expand growing cannabis. And that was my love, a list of some of the things that The Farmer in the Sky, me and my writing partner, Kevin, brought to cannabis. Let's see. Sea of green, screen of green. The salt and ceramic metal halides, the ceramic high pressure sodiums, the use of succinate as a rejuvenant for your sick plants. The first control units that shut off your CO2 if you were exhausting. First speculation in writing about the possibilities of doing sealed rooms. And the reason it was just speculation is because until we had the ductless split minis, there was no way to properly seal a room to do sealed room growing. What else? The extended dark, right? The 24 to 72 hour dark at the flip in order to bring on stronger induction of Florigen production. That was ours. And it wasn't until here, probably 3 years ago, that I finally learned what it was that was doing, which was changing the PR to PFR ratio, the phytochrome red to phytochrome far red ratio. Let me see. There was some others. We wrote about aquaponics before the word aquaponics had been devised. We wrote about it as organic hydroponics. UV, there had already been speculation and writing about UV. The first practical method of UV supplementation we wrote about in an article in February of 1986 in High Times. I don't claim to have brought horizontal trellising to it, but the specific method called true screen of green, which is the 2x2s done. You're not lollipopping, you're growing a plant that from the top of the medium to the end of the farthest meristem is 18 to 24 inches max. It's just a way to get the highest yield per year per square foot. And that's, if you're in commercial production, yield per square foot per year is what you're after, unless you can make up for yield with quality. If you've got the value add of having the best quality, you don't have to have as big a yield. Personally, I want to have the biggest yield of the best quality. And I mean, that's another thing. People don't seem to understand, if you want to compare yields, that there is only one method that allows accurate comparison of dissimilar techniques and technologies. You take the total yield of product per year, including if you only did one crop and you're comparing single crops, then you figure out how many of that length crop you could have done per year. You take total yield per year, you divide it by the total area that it took to produce it. And that would be including maternity ward, nursery, veg, and flower. So your grams per square foot per yield, then it doesn't matter if you did a 5-month crop, then you got 2.5 your crops per year, right? 2.5 crop yields divided by square foot. There's a figure that lets you compare dissimilar methods and techs. That's the Siegel formula.
It has been said that for the average male, the most defining years are those from your early 30s to about 50 years old. These are the years where accomplishments accumulate and legacies are written. These are the years where the tenacity and curiosity of youth get cemented into a road forward. From the ages of 33 to 48, Wolf Siegel was behind prison bars serving time for a cannabis conviction. While his peers went on to fame and public recognition during the rise of medicinal cannabis programs, one of the architects of indoor cannabis horticulture was kept in obscurity out of the limelight.
Bringing in the first really big crops that I did was really fun. I mean, when they took me down in Green Merchant, they did charge me with 12,000 plus plants. The U.S. attorney, Jonathan Hobb, the assistant U.S. attorney that had my piece of Green Merchant, kept referring to what I was doing over and over and over again as a multi-state network of extremely sophisticated indoor grow operations. Now, I didn't think they were that sophisticated. Sure, we had CO2 and like that and had it well-timed, but it wasn't all that sophisticated. It wasn't hydroponic. It wasn't aquaponic. But that was sufficient. And then there's actually a story connected to that, too, which is that in those days when you pled guilty in federal court, if it was the result of a plea bargain and the judge had been present during the plea bargaining session, he was bound by the terms of that plea bargain. Now, this was only in federal court, and that's changed, so now they're not bound either. But we got them to agree, instead of charging me with the 12,000 plus I was originally charged with, they would go 3,999, and they would stipulate that the date of offense was prior to November 17, 1987, which meant that for sentencing purposes, each of the 3,999 plants I pled down to from the 12,000 plus I was originally indicted on would only count as 100 grams instead of 1,000 grams. So instead of it being 3,999 kilos that I was sentenced on, it was 3,999, give or take, times 100 grams, which is what they called each plant for sentencing purposes. Now, the reason that I took the guilty plea is because we had showed the judge pictures of me on the fishing dock in Kailua Kona, standing in front of a sign with what fish I had caught, the name of the boat I'd been on, the date, the name of the skipper, my name. We showed that I was on the dock in Kailua Kona, Hawaii, on the 23rd of December, 1987. The primary witness against me that tied me in with what they were tying me in with said that I had been conspiring with him at the Pink Flamingo Hotel at approximately 4 o'clock in the afternoon on December 23rd, 1987. So here we have a picture of me on the dock. We have phone records. We have my hotel records. We have a copy of the traffic citation from a fender bender I'd been in on the 22nd of December. The judge ruled that the witness was reliable. At that point, I knew I was going to have to take a guilty plea, that there was no way I was going to come out of this okay. So it was obvious to me I had to plead guilty. And we got them to agree to less than 4,000 plants. That took it from me looking at a 20-year mandatory minimum to life. It took it down quite a ways. The 3,999 was right below where the next line was, which was 4,000. We got it to be 100 grams a plant, which, you know, that makes it a tenth as bad as a kilo. And I ended up being locked down, except for 11 months, I was away from the 28th of October, 1989, until the 24th of February, 2005. During that time, cannabis underwent quite a bit of change. As a law clerk in federal prison library, a bunch of us did the prep work for a case called US v. $405,832 for 9 months in the Ninth Circuit. If your property had been through criminal forfeiture prior to your criminal proceedings, you were regarded as having been through a prior jeopardy for double jeopardy purposes. The Supremes reversed it, but that was a pretty major thing that we did, that inmates did, that prisoners did. Lawyers carried it the rest of the way, but we prepared it. This is when three generations from now, I hope someone is going to remember that, yeah, there was this guy who did a lot. And we're here because that happened then. Yeah, I mean, that's another piece. Hydrotech and I were the number four target in Green Merchant. The only things they wanted more was Sinsemia Tips magazine, High Times magazine, and Neville. Patrick Schwartz, the agent who was in charge of the West Coast element of Green Merchant, told me that. And I mean, it's my politics. It's my, I was the third non-attorney life member of National Normal. I gave them $10,000 in 1979. Before Green Merchant, I'd spent $250,000 on anti-prohibition measures.
Wolf Siegel, despite his time away from society because of cannabis, still passionately believes in the medicinal and general benefits the cannabis plant offers. As he did before the world paid attention, he continues to tinker and look for creative, new, and efficient methods of cultivation. While many know of his technical contributions to cannabis cultivation, hopefully more people out there will now know the name that goes with it. His focus is currently centered on regenerative methods of growing, reducing the carbon footprint, and keeping the culture of legacy cannabis alive.
My life has been very, very wrapped up in and around cannabis. Pot for me is part of my politics. It's part of my making the world a better place. It's how I relate to people socially. It's the best social lubricant I know, which takes me to another thing, which is the late Dennis Perone, again, rise in power, Dennis. The late Dennis Perone said all cannabis is medical. And I don't know if I agree that all cannabis use is medical, but I think that about 90% of so-called adult use cannabis is people self-medicating for undiagnosed cases of subclinical social anxiety disorder, in support of which I point to how commonly it's used as a social lubricant, the icebreaker when you first meet people. It is the most effective social lubricant I know. And I think that that's one of its best qualities. But the best cannabis experience that I have ever had was the first time that I made full ensemble cannabis extract for someone else. And it was for some parents whose kid was having a seizure, having seizures, I should say. And I made a batch of, some people call it RSO, I call it full ensemble cannabis extract. And when they came back and told me, almost a year later, that since they'd been doing it, their kid had not had one seizure. That's as good as it gets. I mean, it's, understand, I have been rich because of cannabis. Before Operation Green Merchant, my end of what I was doing was $19,500 a week. That was a lot of money in 1989. It's still a healthy amount of money now. But that didn't begin to compare when a parent thanks you because their kid is not having seizures, when a vet stops having nightmares because of something you gave them. That's as good as it gets. It really is. we are going to get our culture back. We're going to go back to, I hope, there's going to be the $4 chuck, PBR, mass, MSO, and MNO, multination organizations producing cannabis. But that PBR and $4 chuck is all going to come from low latitudes. If people want to grow cannabis more than just for themselves, if they want to grow commercially in North America, they're going to have to step up their game. They're going to have to grow biotically. They're going to have to give light that's heliomimetic. They're going to have to start paying attention to what land races have. And they're going to have to start really, like I said, stepping it up. Because if I can grow Mazar-e Sharif in Balkh province, I guarantee it's going to be better than Mazar-e Sharif grown even in Northern California. You know, as we get rid of the bullshit and as we stop, ideally, as we stop being second-class citizens because of our choice in medicines and social lubricants, we'll start seeing positive change, which is all about healthy grow methods, about biotic grow methods. And that's another piece of what my current mission is. I'm very much about preaching that growing greener, using greener methods, is growing wiser. Because in the world as it is, it takes roughly 2.5 acres to sustain the CO2, to sequester the CO2 put out by 1,000 watts of electricity. Those figures come from a study done by the University of New Mexico, averaging CO2 production across all means of generation of electricity. And then another study done at UC Boulder, in which they calculated what the average sequestration of CO2 per year per tree is. And we can't afford to keep doing that. All you have to do is look at the weather for the last 3 years. 30 years ago, they said if we fixed everything, things would continue to deteriorate for 20 more years. It's 30 years later. We started doing stuff like 10 years ago. Last year, Deer Island, Oregon, had a day that it was hotter than Death Valley, California. The Inuit and Inuit elders say that the sky has changed. I don't know exactly what they mean by that, but I think we may be past the tipping point, but we're certainly at a point where we can't afford to be using destructive methods, extractive methods, when there's sustainable regenerative methods available as an alternative. It's healthier pot when it's grown properly. It'll get you off better when it's grown properly. It tastes better when it's grown properly. And it doesn't make sense to spend more money to haul water from thousands of miles away instead of making our nutrients locally. Think about the gas. Think about moving things. You know, pay attention to what it takes to get the materials to you, because that is part of the footprint too. You know, I'm big on people local sourcing. So now I'm very much the next book, the book that I'm working on now is called How to Grow Wiser, a cultivator's handbook for growing cannabis sustainably. Hopefully it will be ready this fall. But if it's ready by 420, I mean, at this point, it's about 3.5 years behind schedule. I'm having health issues. I've been homeless, but not roofless, for 2 years. It's been a challenge. But we'll see how it goes. You know, I don't surrender. If someone wants to learn more about light, more about sustainable growth, more about all of that stuff, just reach out to me, wolf@farmerinthesky.com. If it's a commercial venture, I do commercial consulting. I'm always happy to answer for individuals who are trying to grow their own or grow some for themselves and a couple of other people. I'm always thrilled to answer 2 or 3 questions, help them along the way, at the very least steer them in the direction where they can find the information they need. And like, if there's one thing I hope you won't edit it out of this, this is to everyone listening. Love yourself. Love your plants. Show your love to the planet by growing sustainably. And remember that growing greener is growing wiser. There's nothing I love like growing. No one I love like growers. These are my people. These are my family. This is my legacy. When three generations from now, I hope someone is going to remember that, yeah, there was this guy who did a lot. And we're here because that happened then.